Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chips Speakers Meeting on NavaZoom, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcohol men and women in our NavaZoom room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear tonight's speaker. And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And before I even knew that I must have this thing, I remember attending my very first few AA meetings, and Daryl was there, probably in the Bridge Builders group, probably in How It Works. I see him at different meetings early on, and he was one of the guys that I would particularly try to pay attention to what he was sharing. It helped me, and I'm so grateful that you're here tonight.
I'm Daryl, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Daryl.
Hi, everybody, and it's only by God's grace and the AA principles and the program of alcoholics that I'm here today, and I believe that solely in my heart. I had a lot of sponsors, and I'll tell you a little bit about each of them as I go through, but one of them said, you know, Daryl, when you share, especially when you're a speaker or a discussion leader, it's probably best that you share from the literature and your heart versus your opinions, because everybody has opinions and you certainly have some. So why don't you stick to the literature? And so I always go to the literature a lot. And, today I read 5 books in the morning, all spiritually based. And one of them is Daily Reflections, and it just caught my eye this morning that it said, of myself I have nothing, the Father doeth the works, began to carry a bright promise and meaning in my life. And that's from the 12 Steps, 12 Traditions from page 75. And, you know, I believe that to be true today, that if I step back and I let my higher power God do the work, and I just take the steps necessary that I can remain somewhat happy, joyous, and free. I also had a sponsor that was, he used to always declare that he was happy, joyous, and free, and I always wanted to be like that. And I think I've become the closest I ever have to it in my 19 years. I just celebrated 19 years on June 20th, so I got sober in 2001. Thank you. I see people clapping. That's awesome. But it wasn't an easy journey for this alcoholic. I grew up in New Jersey. Don't hold that against me. But I grew up there, and I grew up with 2 alcoholics. Parents, and it wasn't the easiest way to grow up, and there was a lot of situations and behaviors, and you know, we all know what it's like to be an active alcoholic, and our stories vary and all that stuff, but we all know what that can do to your behaviors and the way you act and the way you live your life. And I swore up and down, I said to myself, I'd never be like them. And lo and behold, I've carried the torch and probably lit it on fire even more after I was raised. But, you know, one evening I woke up to my sister, my older sister, knocking on my bedroom door, and it was filling up with smoke in the ceiling, and I could see it with the light. And I was young, and we had a two-story house, and there was smoke filling the room, and she said, come on, come on, come on, we got to get out of here. And there's a fire, and I went to the banister or the edge of the stairs, and there was this big flame pouring up the stairwell. And so my sister and I basically scaled the wall to get past it. And we found this old lounge chair, a Lazy Boy that was made. It was purple because it was, you know, back in the 70s. And it was on fire and it was torched and it was just blazing. And we went to get my mom, and my mom wouldn't wake up. She was passed out. And so her and I, my sister and I, took buckets or pots and pans full of water to douse out the fire. And that evening, I don't know where my dad was at the time, but he wasn't around. And I remember the next day or the next day and a half, not really understanding anything that occurred. And my dad and I brought the burnt up chair, and in New Jersey you put out your garbage at the curb, and the guys would pick it up no matter what it was. And so I remember the embarrassment of having this burned up chair in my front yard for a couple of days until they picked it up. And you know, that I don't tell those stories to shame my parents or to say that they're the ones that made me an alcoholic, but I did have several instances where windows were breaking, garbage cans were thrown against the house, cars were parked on the opposite side of the street, policemen came to the house, you know, the whole alcoholic thing. You know, when I was growing up, they might as well have painted on the side of the house, alcoholics live here. And because we really made a story of ourselves through our active alcoholism, and I trailed right behind that. I had my first beer in the woods out behind the house when I was 14, and I'll never forget, it tasted horrible, and I was like, that's disgusting. And so we threw it away, but then one day me and my friend decide that we're going to take my mother's boxed Chablis and boxed Burgundy one day in the basement, and we decided that we would take two big cups, fill them with half and half, because that would make it stronger, and we would get this elusive feeling that people talked about. And we drank it, and it made me nauseous. The room started to spin. I threw up. I passed out. My mother came home, didn't understand why I was sleeping. But, you know, the next day, me and my friend got together, and we said, when are we going to do that again? You know, and so regardless of the consequences, I already knew that I liked that feeling that alcohol gave me. And, you know, I could hit you with a bunch of drunkologues and drunk stories, but you know, I wish I could say that I came in here and slid on pillows to get into these rooms, and I really slid on some serious glass. As alcoholism does, it progressed through me, and as I drank more and more through my teens, and through my young adulthood, especially young adulthood is when I really started to see some consequences flare. And, you know, I had in Atlanta by the time I was about 20 some odd years old, I had two DUIs and a hit and run, and all in the same year. And that doesn't count the DUI that I had in Florida several years before. And you know, I didn't care about anybody. I really didn't. I was so self-centered, self-absorbed that I just thought that it doesn't matter if I drink and drive. It doesn't matter if I pass out. It doesn't matter if I fall against the wall. I don't care, you know. And I was into the poor me a lot. And poor me drink, right? And so this guy, I go on a consultation. Okay, that's how I got here. I went on a consultation to another lawyer. And his name was Bubba, and he was 6'2", 300 pounds, and he scared the pants off of me. But I heard he was the best DUI lawyer in the state. And I went to Bubba, and I said, you know, how are you going to get me out of these things? And he said, well, first of all, I think you should stop drinking. And I honestly, folks, I did not see the point of that. I did not understand what my drinking had to do with it. I always thought that I was in the wrong place, wrong time. And so Bubba shortly there said, why don't you go get this test? And I want you to see if you pass or fail. And he sent me to Ridgeview. Peachford, and I took this multiple choice question sheet of 100 questions about alcohol and the way I drank, and I lied up and down every which way I could. If it said, you know, do you drink a six pack and less than a six pack or more, or a case or more a night, check this box. And I said I drank a six pack or less, and that was a lie. And I lied all through the test, and this young man turns to me after the test and he says, after the assessment, Mr. Start, we believe that we're 97% sure you're an alcoholic. And I was like, oh man. And I couldn't even lie my way through it anymore. And, you know, I wish I could tell you all the stories, but you know, the fact of the matter is that I drank to escape, and I couldn't face life successfully. And my sponsor today tells me a lot of that. And, you know, by the way, I have two sponsors because it takes a village to raise a baby, and it takes two sponsors to raise Daryl. And I believe that to be true today. I need all the help I can get, even after some time in the program. And this one situation happened. Well, let me tell you one before. Oh, I know what it was. So my last drink, this is the way it plotted out. I knew I had to quit. I knew the gig was up. I didn't know what to do except try to stop. And so I, after a night of drinking heavily, once again, swearing up and down and breaking promises to myself again, I said, I'm not going to drink tonight. And by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I was ready to go pound a few. And, but I kept saying to myself, I promise myself, I'm not going to do it tonight. I'm not going to do it. And sure enough, my drinking buddy, because I only hung out with people that drank like me, and if you didn't, I would cut you out of my life. And my buddy calls me and he's like, come on, just, you know, one or two drinks. Let's just go for one or two drinks. And I was like, all right, fine. We'll go to the Mexican bar since it's not far away. And the reason why I went to the Mexican place was, one main reason, and that was because there I could have two drinks, but there were 32-ounce beers. So I knew I would get at least some sort of buzz, something going on with 64 ounces of beer. And sure enough, you know, as many promises as I made to myself that day and that evening, I end up on the wrong side of the road on Ashford Dunwoody at 2 o'clock in the morning, blacked out, woken up by blue lights. And I promise you people, you know, you can say it was a white light. It was a moment of clarity. You could call it whatever you want. But this time when I got handcuffed, I knew the gig was up. I knew something inside of me that had finally said that this has got to be the end. Otherwise, I will do what the big book talks about and drink to the bitter end and die or go to an insane asylum or prison. And so I got through that night. And the next day, I get through jail, and which was totally annoying, because all they did was move me around, and I slept on concrete all night and ate turkey sandwiches, and my buddy bails me out, and again, and we're driving past the Circle K, and it's 11 o'clock in the morning the next day after I got a DUI and blew a 2.8 or whatever it was. It was pretty high, and as so was I. And I stopped by a Circle K, and I go and get myself a case or 12-pack, whatever it was, because I deserved a drink. I deserved it after a night of living hell. So after all the promises I'd made, all the swearing up and down I would never do it again, I found myself back in that rabbit hole. And I go into Circle K and I grab my 12-pack or case of beer, I don't even remember what it was. And I'm walking out of the doorway, and straight ahead there's a police car parked towards the store, and there's an officer getting into his car to leave, and it's one of the arresting officers. And he didn't say anything. He didn't look at me like I was a criminal. He just made this sort of face and just raised his hand and gave me a nice wave. And I believe that was another moment of clarity that this gig was up. And because how do you position that now that I look back? How do you position that without God's help? I don't see that happening. So 2 days later after that, I was supposed to go to New Jersey to go to my best friend's wedding from high school, who I drank constantly with. And I called my dad, who had 15 years of sobriety at the time, I believe. I can't quote it, but he had several years. And we weren't on speaking terms for a few years because of me. And I ended up flying up to New York City, and I kept telling my dad, I got to talk to you. And he kept saying, about what? And I said, I just got to talk to you. And so I went in to New York City, and we went to Central Park in the rain and grabbed a couple of hoagies or subs, as you guys call them, and sat in the park, and I spilled my guts to him. I told him every little detail of what I was going through and how afraid I was and that I didn't know what to do anymore. And the first thing he did was say, let's go to a meeting. So he took me to my first meeting, and I was very drawn back from the fact that you guys held hands in the beginning of the meeting and said the serenity prayer. And that kind of freaked me out. And the first word of the serenity prayer was God, and I had none. And so my dad basically took me into his home for a couple of weeks while I detoxed, and he took me to meetings every day. And then I had to come down to Atlanta on my own again, and I went to the one at Oglethorpe, and they had a beginner's meeting at 7 p.m., and I sat in my car, and I saw seven people go in. I said, there's no way I'm going into that meeting. I'm not going to be called out, and I'm going to hide. And I came in late, left early, And I talked to my sponsor at the time, and he said, you might want to wait for the next meeting. So I waited for the next meeting, and there were 30 people that went in there, and I finally picked up a white chip in Atlanta. And so my first sponsor, I remember him leaning across the table and said, the first thing I want to know from you, Daryl, is are you an alcoholic? And I said, yes, I am. And he said, that doesn't work. I want you to look me in the eyes and tell me you're an alcoholic. And I was like, I didn't know how to look anybody in the eyes. I really didn't. I was terrified of looking at a man in his eyes and saying that I was an alcoholic. And he, I turned away from him and kept saying that. He said, no, I want you to look at me. And I finally looked at a man and felt like a man for the first time in my life. And I was fortunate enough to go through a 12-step, 18-week sponsor and sponsee program at 8111 in a small basement, I think it was at the time. And out of 12 of us, 4 of us were left at the end when we finished 12-step. And so that shows how cunning, baffling, and powerful this disease really is, and how many of us, and the percentage of what actually occurred there. I remember one guy, he kept picking up white chips every week, every week, every week. And then he never came back, and we never heard from him. And so we never knew if he lived through it. And that scared me enough to stay in the program. Now, one of my first AA meetings, this old lady, Sheila, came up to me and she said, you know what I think's happening to you, Daryl? And I said, what? Because I was smiling at the time. And she said, you're finally starting to get sober. Really sober. And I had been making coffee for the past month, which was highly suggested by my sponsor. And I found myself smiling doing it. And I remember that lady for the rest of my life. And I remember her face in the exact meeting we were at Mount Vernon. And that started to give me hope. And then, you know, my sponsor early on, they were pretty tough on me, which I needed, because I was rebellious and I didn't want to do anything that was asked of me. And he said, for a while, Daryl, because I was like, when do I share? When do I start sharing? When do I share? When do I share? And he's like, why don't you take the cotton out of your ears for a while, stick it in your mouth? And then we, from then on, I promise you, it was at least 3 months before I shared a word. I needed that type of sponsorship that would guide me, you know, because I was one of the most undisciplined people you could think of. I was reckless and I did exactly what I wanted to when I was out there. So after that, he passed away and his name was Papa Bill, and I cherish that man. He changed my life forever. And I remember, I'll tell this story real quick. He always sort of worked the steps together. It was 1 and 2, 3 and 4, 5 and 6, 6 and 7 at the same time, and then 8 and 9, and then 10 and 11, and then 12 by itself. And I remember us doing 3, and 2 and 3, we're discussing 2, and all of a sudden he's like, we're on step 3. And I'm like, what? And so he was like, I want you to turn to the prayer. And I was like, I've never prayed before, Papa Bill. And he was like, well, you're going to now. And he said, I want you to bring your book, and we're going to go into my bedroom, and we're going to hold hands, and we're going to kneel, and you're going to recite the book, and I'm going to pray. And the two of us held hands at bedside and knelt. And I was totally not okay with any of it. And when we said the prayer together and held hands, and I closed my eyes for a moment and looked up, and all of a sudden there was a sense of peace. And he said, I can never, ever ask for again. And that peace to me continues today, only through prayer and meditation in my higher power. Like I said, I got two sponsors now. One is Mr. Practical, and he takes care of all my relationship business and job business. And both of them are spiritual teachers, and one is as humble as you can make him. And he just, whenever I come to these guys with a problem, they always tell me to face the principles and face my fears. I don't know about you, but it was all about fear when I was out there. And it's still, fear has got to be the most crippling part to sobriety that I've ever encountered. The closest I've ever gotten to a drink was through fear. And now today they teach me to put my big boy pants on. And they always say the way through fear is through it. And I used to drink really hard at problems, and today I pray hard at problems, and it works. And today, you know, I have this sense of peace and ease that I can't even begin to tell you, but you play the tape back, and I was the only time I ever had, I thought that elusive feeling of peace and ease was when I was hammered. And I'm going to end this with one reading from the book real quick. And this is the way I see AA for me today. And it's in the King, the Keys to the Kingdom, and it's on 275. Excuse me. It says, AA is not a plan of recovery that can be finished and done with. It's a way of life, and the challenge contained in its principles is great enough to keep human beings striving for as long as he lives. We do not, cannot outgrow this plan. As arrested alcoholics, we must have a program for living that allows for limitlessness expansion. Keeping one foot in front of the other is essential for maintaining our arrestment. Others may idle in retrogressive groove without too much danger, but retrogression can spell death for us. A complete change takes place in our approach to life. Where we used to run from responsibility, we find ourselves accepting it with gratitude that we can successfully shoulder it. Instead of wanting to escape some perplexing problems, we experience the thrill and the challenge and the opportunity it affords, another application of AA's techniques. And we find ourselves tackling it with surprising vigor. So that's my story, and I thank you all for your time tonight, and I hope you have a fabulous rest of the night, and thank you so much.
Thanks, Daryl.
Thanks a lot, Daryl.
Thank you, Daryl.
Thank you.
A life of prayer and service sure beats our old way of life.
Just another homesick child, tired of running wild, ready to stand trial and move on. Though I'm guilty in this time, ask for mercy tonight. I can't make it through this fight all alone. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't stress shine enough light on me till I'm freed from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. As I try to make some sense of this world I'm up against, well, I know my best defense is your love. When the struggle gets insane and the lessons fall apart, keep me calling out your name with
love. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt. The bottom of my heart, and I'm searching for one star to shine. I will shout from mountain high, and I'll reach into the sky till you open up my eyes so blind. But oh Lord, don't make it easy. Keep me working till I work it on out. But please, please, won't you shine enough light on me till I'm free from the shadow of doubt. Keep me out of the shadow of doubt.